This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
In the 50s and 60s, as the old Hollywood studio system was starting to break down, a generation of young filmmakers came up who wanted to do things in their own way. They'd later be called auteurs. And among the boldest of them, and certainly one of the most prolific and commercial, was Roger Corman. Corman worked fast and he worked cheap. Again and again, he pushed the boundaries of what you could put into a movie. He did monster movies, horror movies, biker movies, crime, drugs. He did it all. It wasn't always high art exactly, but he undeniably had a vision for himself, and he helped define a new era in movies. In 2014, Roger Corman sat down for a conversation with Tad Friend, a staff writer at The New Yorker.
One way to introduce Roger Corman is to list some of his many accomplishments. But another, and I think better way to introduce Roger is just to show what he's been up to. Could we roll the trailer for Sharktopus, please?
S-11 is now totally under our control. Blue Water Corps has just created the Navy's next super weapon.
So what are the elements that you'd like to get in a trailer? I think we just saw it, but...
Actually, you saw it. The idea is to have the creature, whatever it may be, and there's a fact of life that very few people realize. Whenever there is a man or woman eating creature just offshore, pretty girls in bikinis always run into the water. I have no idea why, but they always do, thus setting us up for great scenes. There's also, you want to do it a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because you don't want to be too serious with this. You give them the horror, you give them the shock, but you give them a little excuse to laugh with it. So they're riding with you as if they're in on the joke.
Right. Now, I think you told me once that even though you'd already made Dino Croc and Piranaconda, you were concerned that Sharktopus might be too much of a stretch as a title.
Yes, what happened was this. I had made this picture called Dino Croc, and Tom Vitale, the head of the Sci-Fi Channel, called me and said he'd like to see it. So I sent it to him, and they bought it, and it got a very high rating. So I was having lunch with the executives of Sci-Fi in New York, and they said they wanted another one. And I said, fine, Dino Croc 2. And this is where even at my age, you can learn something new. They said, no. For motion pictures, you can have a Rocky 2 or a Rambo 2 or whatever. But for us, we find that doesn't work. We want something similar. And I said, did I say Dino Croc 2? Of course I meant Super Gator. They said, right, we'll make Super Gator.
Right. So often with a film like Attack of the Crab Monsters, you would come up with the title first. That was the first thing that occurred to you, and then you'd kind of fill in all the other details later. And there was one time, I think, where you actually had just had a title and you went out to distributors with only the title, right, with, for student the student nurses?
Yes.
And they wanted it, and therefore you decided you could make such a film.
That was when I started my own company, New World. I was primarily a producer, independent producer director, going through various independent companies. And with all producers directors, you can interview producers and directors from all over the world, and every one of them will tell you, I've been had by the distribution company. It was not a fair count. And that actually happened to me, and I said, I'm going to start my own company, New World. And so I talked to theater owners, and they liked the title Student Nurses, and so we made Student Nurses.
Well, diving back to the beginning, after training as an engineer, you went to work for 20th Century Fox in the late 40s, in the mailroom first, and then as a story reader. And what happened next?
The story editor called me in. He said, Roger, you have never given the idea of the reader. They had a fancy name, story analyst, so we were just readers. We read scripts, novels, short stories, treatments, whatever, that were submitted as possible pictures. And he said, you're the only person here who has never given a positive review to anything. And I said, that's because I'm the youngest guy in the department. You give me all the worst stuff. I'm not going to praise something that's no good. So then they sent me a Western called The Big Gun, which I knew that they had a pay-or-play commitment with Gregory Peck to do a Western. I praised it and made some suggestions, and they bought it. And they made it as The Gunfighter, which became sort of a classic classic Western. And the story editor got a bonus for my suggestions. So I left and I went to England and went to graduate work.
Did you learn anything from your studio experience? Or did you feel like you learned what not to do? Or did you learn anything to do as well?
Actually, I learned a number of things. First, you have to sort of accept the fact that you're part of a team. You're not functioning individually. But I did get an appreciation for how hard everybody really worked to make the films. I hadn't realized the intensity with which everybody makes films.
And you were then later famous for your intensity in terms of just producing so many films so fast. What was your route from England to becoming a director? How did that happen?
I came back to the United States and started writing, and I wasn't making any money. And I got a job as an assistant to a literary agent, and I wrote a script, put a different name on it, and the literary agency sold that script. So I explained what happened to the head of the agency. He said, he just laughed. He said, sure, why not? So I paid them the commission. And then I said to the producer I'd sold the script to, I would like to work as your assistant on the picture, and I don't want any more money, but I'd like to get a credit as associate producer. And he said, certainly, because in Hollywood, your credits are very important. So I was able, when that picture came out, to state that I had a credit as, producer, associate producer and writer, and I raised a little money and made my first picture on my own.
So one of the best known of your early films was The Little Shop of Horrors, which you shot in 2 days and a night, which is probably a record of some kind. In fact, I've never heard of anything shot that fast. Why did you move that fast? Why was, you know, what was it?
It was almost a joke. There was a standing set at this studio. I was working out of a small rental studio in Hollywood. They built this fairly good set. And I just thought that I'd like to gamble and do something. And I thought, why not deliberately set up a comedy horror film? So with 2 days and a night, I tried The Little Shop of Horrors as an experiment, and the thing went way beyond my belief.
Let's take a look at a clip from Little Shop of Horrors.
This is gonna hurt you more than it is me.
Oh, goody, goody, here it comes. Oh, my God, don't stop now!
Well, I made a lot of holes, and now I gotta fill it up with this here silver stuff.
Well, aren't you gonna pull any?
Well,
Oh, go on.
Well, it's your mouth.
In case you didn't recognize him, that was Jack Nicholson as a young man.
Was it bittersweet for you to think that the people who you brought to notice and who did well would then go on to leave you. I think you told Ron Howard, who directed Grand Theft Auto for you, if you do a good job on this film, you'll never have to work for me again. what is the dynamic behind that? Is it just sort of the parent sending the kid off to school, or what? I mean, and waving goodbye, or what? How do you feel about knowing that someone who's really terrific is going to probably want to do a bigger budget thing after that?
I think it's inevitable. I would think of it as being somewhat equivalent to baseball, being have a good minor league team, knowing that your guys, your best guys, are going to go on to the majors. I wish them all well, and with almost every one of them, I'm still friends. So it's been a good relationship on right. both sides.
Well, in proceeding a little bit chronologically, in 1962, when Hollywood in general was still, actually hadn't even begun to start making The Sound of Music, you released The Intruder, which was an extremely raw look at segregation. You shot the film in a small town in Missouri, in the Boot Hill, Missouri, you were saying. Tell us about how you filmed that particular scene.
Well, that was incidentally Bill Shatner in his first Hollywood picture. I wanted to shoot the picture in the South because I was only going to have, I think, four actors from Hollywood. I wanted the authentic look of the South, and I knew I was going to have townspeople playing the supporting roles. But I didn't want to be in Alabama or Mississippi where I felt people were getting killed. So I was in the Northern South. I had the look of the South, and for the townspeople, I had the right accent. And I felt because I'm in Missouri, I'll be under the laws of a Midwestern state. The first part worked. I got the look at the South, and I got the accents. The law didn't work. I was thrown out of three towns and by the sheriffs, and we had death threats. It was pretty wild.
This is a really riveting film, and it was also the first one of your films to lose money. And I think you've said you've learned a lesson from that, which was?
Well, the lesson was this. You can't lecture to the audience. The reviews were spectacular. I think one of the New York magazines, I still remember it, we shot the picture in 1960, it said, "This motion picture is a major credit to the entire American film industry."
I think Jonathan Demme suggested approvingly that the formula behind your films was a good degree of sex, some violence, a bit of nudity, and perhaps a subtle social statement.
On some of the films, it's pretty hard to find the social statement. Sharktopus does not have a major social statement other than that beware of a mutant shark.
Which is important. When you look at like a big budget Hollywood film, are there, other than the fact that the budgets are bigger and maybe the stars are sometimes more recognizable, are they including kinds of scenes or moments or thematic stuff that you feel like you don't have in your films, or is it exactly the same thing, just multiplied 20x?
Marty Scorsese once said, "Roger never saw a film he couldn't cut."
After shooting more than 50 films in about 15 years, you basically retired from directing in 1971, with one or two exceptions. What led to that decision?
I was shooting a picture called Von Richthofen and Brown, a World War I flying film in Ireland, and I was just tired. I'd made too many films in too short a period of time. I intended to stop just for a year to take the traditional sabbatical and come back. But I started my own company, New World, and it got off to such an amazing start. I just ended up staying, with one or two exceptions, running New World.
Joan Didion once said about your The Wild Angels, which is the first biker film, that she'd gone to see it because there on the screen was some news I was not getting from the New York Times. I began to think I was seeing ideograms of the future. Did you consciously try to stay abreast of or ahead of the culture? Was that part of your thinking, to try to be?
Yeah. That was the first film I did after the Edgar Allan Poe films. All the Edgar Allan Poe films were shot in studios, and I wanted to break away from what you might call the artificiality of the studio, and particularly the period pictures, and I wanted to go out in the streets and shoot contemporary life. And at that time, the Hell's Angels were very famous. They were, as a matter of fact, I got the idea. There was a picture in either Time or Newsweek of a funeral of a Hell's Angel. And people were carrying the coffin, and the angels were all riding their bikes, their motorcycles. And I started with that picture, and that was the climax of the film, the death of Bruce Dern, incidentally. I used the real Hell's Angels in the picture, and Chuck Griffith, the writer, and I went to the Hell's Angels parties. We were always welcome because we were the guys who brought the marijuana. So we were on it, and everything in the picture was based on things they told us leading up to the funeral scene. And that's why I wanted to, as I say, step totally away with what I've been doing and start shooting what was going on in America in the 60s.
Right, and then there was also the acid film. So you were, and you came from your own, partly from your own experiences with LSD, right? So,
yes.
So you were actually kind of living the life that you were putting on screen in some ways.
To a certain extent.
What some people may not know is actually in the 70s, in addition to making films and producing them, you were, New World Films, your company was also distributing foreign masters, people like Fellini and Truffaut and Kurosawa in America. And in 1974, you could actually go see a double feature of Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers and your Women in Prison film, Caged Heat, which I was wondering, what was the sweet spot of the viewer who wanted to see both of those back to back?
That was just a wild idea. The whole thing started with this. New World grew incredibly to the point where within 2 years, we were the biggest independent distribution company in America. And I'd always loved the films of Bergman, Fellini, Truffaut, and so forth, and I felt they were not getting good releases in the United States. They were being distributed by small companies who were really aficionados, but couldn't effectively get the pictures into theaters on the right terms, or they were being distributed by the majors who really know how brilliantly to distribute a big budget film, but didn't quite understand how to distribute these films. And it's simply, I wanted to bring these films to the audience. It wasn't charity. I didn't plan on losing money. But I thought if I can at least break even on this, I simply want to do it as a personal thing. And the first one was Cries and Whispers, and it got an Academy Award. And it was the fall when drive-ins were closing down, but they were still trying to pick up some product to play, and I knew nobody wanted to give them important pictures because the weather was turning on them. And I thought, why not put Cries and Whispers in a drive-in? And I did, and I didn't remember the Caged Heat was with it. I just remember we put it in a drive-in, and it did average business. And the drive-in owner and I were delighted to one of the few times we were delighted to do average business, and I got a letter from Bergman thanking me for bringing his picture to an audience he had never anticipated to be seen.
I just wanted to ask one more thing. In your autobiography, you wrote, art was not something I consciously aspired to create. My job was to be a good craftsman. Did you ever think about, you know, hey, what would have happened if I'd unleashed all my artistic impulses? Did you ever decide, you know, like wonder, could I have gone another way?
Well, after The Intruder, several people told me, despite the commercial failure of The Intruder, I should have stayed in that bracket, and maybe I made a mistake in going the other way. But what I tried to do, the statement about being a craftsman, I felt with the films I'm making, and I think with almost anybody who's working creatively, to say that I am an artist, I am creating a great work of art, is to be putting yourself sort of ahead of it. I think the thing to do is to be a craftsman, to do the best possible job you can do on what you're doing, and if occasionally it rises to the level of art, that's great. But essentially, you're a craftsman.
Great. Well, thank you all very much for coming on. I also want to thank our guest, Roger Cohn.
The New Yorker's Tad Friend speaking in 2014 with Roger Corman. Corman's latest film is Death Race 2050, which he produced with his wife, Julie Corman.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.